welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of October 22nd, 2018. This week, our guest is author and historian Jim Jordan. Jim is retired and lives in South Carolina and is the author of two previous books, both novels, entitled Savannah Gray, A Tale of Antebellum Savannah, and Penny Savannah, A Tale of Civil War Savannah. Jim joins me today to talk about his latest book, entitled The Slave Trader's Letter Book, Charles Lamar, The Wanderer, and Other Tales of the African Slave Trade, published in 2018 by the University of Georgia Press. Jim tells the fascinating story of Charles Lamar, who survived a steamboat explosion at sea when he was 14 years old, and who went on to become a notorious slave trader, bringing what turned out to be the illegal penultimate shipment of slaves from Africa to the United States in 1858, when he landed 400 enslaved people on board the Wanderer on Jekyll Island. Lamar's papers, including his letter book, were long thought to be lost until 2009, when the Georgia Historical Society was contacted about a trunk full of papers in an attic in New Jersey. Jim, at his own expense, traveled to New Jersey, purchased the cache of papers, and donated them to the Georgia Historical Society. He tells the whole story of Charles Lamar, the Wanderer, and the missing papers in this interview, recorded in Savannah at the Jepson House Education Center at the Georgia Historical Society on October 3rd, 2018. Here's Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here, Stan.
So, the title of your book is The Slave Trader's Letter Book, Charles Lamar, The Wanderer, and Other Tales of the African Slave Trade. And as the title suggests, there are many different stories in this book. The first thing I want to ask you is, I know that you're not a trained historian, but you're an awfully good one. How did you come to being a historian writing this book? What did you do for a living before that?
Before I wrote the book, I was a CPA, and I helped companies put computer systems in their environments, financial computer systems. I retired in the year 2000 to play a lot of great golf. Didn't work out so well. I got a little frustrated and threw my clubs in the pond. I needed something to do with my retirement, so I live in Okotie, South Carolina, nearby Savannah. I always liked history and architecture, so I decided I'd become a tour guide. I came in, got a job as a tour guide, and I found myself spending more time studying for tours than actually giving tours. I was so fascinated by the history. And then I discovered the Georgia Historical Society and the library there, and I spent my mornings giving tours and my afternoons in the Georgia Historical Society reading. And I got so involved in the history of the area that I decided I had to write a book. And I did. I wrote an historical novel called Savannah Gray, but took 4.5 years, but it didn't satisfy my appetite. I knew I had to do more research and write more. And that's how I eventually evolved into writing the Slave Trader's Letter Book.
How did you get interested in Charles Lamar?
I read an account by his aunt of Charles Lamar, his father, his mother, his three sisters, his two brothers, an aunt, and a cousin going on a ship from Savannah up to Baltimore. And that ship, the SS Pulaski, exploded at sea off the coast of North Carolina. And Charlie lost his mother, three sisters, two brothers, and his cousin. Only his father and his aunt, Rebecca, who wrote the account, survived.
And what year was that?
That was 1838.
Tragic accident.
Tragic. The numbers are not really certain, but the most quoted number is that 195 passengers and crew were on the ship and only 59 survived.
Wow.
Charlie survived 5 nights and 5 days at sea on a piece of wreckage with his aunt. Originally, there were about 23 or 24 people on that piece of wreckage. Only 7 survived. Well, actually 13, because 6 men took one of the rowboats and went to the coast to get help. but the others died, 11 or 12 just died of dehydration or went delirious. But Charles survived. He almost died, but he survived as a 14-year-old. And then I read more about him, and here's this teenager, a hero that survived this incredible disaster, who turns out to be one of the major slave traders in U.S. history. So I had to fill in the blanks, and I did. I researched his life, and from what letters I could garner and what newspaper reports I could get, and I put the pieces together. But it wasn't until I discovered long-lost Gasway Lamar papers that I discovered a letter book of Charles that filled in all the holes in Charlie's life.
Do you know by his own reckoning if that explosion, clearly it had an effect on the rest of his life, but by his own telling, do you know how that tragedy shaped his life?
He never mentioned it again in any document I ever found. I never heard anybody else refer to it except for a reporter from the New York Tribune, who mentioned it. But other than that, he never mentioned it at all.
So what years what years are we talking about? He was born and died when?
He was born in 1824, April Fool's Day, and he died in April 1865. So it was probably made it to his 41st birthday. He died in one of the last battles of the Civil War, the Battle of Columbus. And to my knowledge, it was the only action he saw in the war. So I do cover his wartime experiences in the book, but it's brief. Most of the book covers his engaging in illegal activities. The slave trade was only the last of his illegal activities. He, of course, was involved in others, specifically the filibustering movement of the 1850s, the Cuban filibustering movement, where a group of private individuals and some Cuban expatriates wanted to hire a mercenary army to invade Cuba, kick out the Spanish, make it into a U.S. territory, divide it up into some sub-territories, and bring them in as slave states into the Union to increase the slave power in Congress.
Right. So, right. Which is why this was so opposed by the free states. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It was, but there were some individuals from free states that got involved in it. They wanted Cuba, but it was mostly, not exclusively, but mostly a Southern endeavor.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in this book, great stories, and they're really kind of inseparable. You can't pull the story of Charles Lamar away from the story of the slave trade and the story of your recovery of the documents that allowed you to tell this story. So I want you to take our listeners through that, and I'll let you do it. But there is a fascinating book, highly recommended, published by the University of Georgia Press. This is published in 2017. Jim's going to be appearing at book festivals in many different places, including Nashville coming up. I want you to talk about that a little bit later. But right now, sort of walk our listeners through the story of Charles Lamar, the story of the letter book and its recovery, and the story of the slave trade, and how this all comes together in your book.
Well, Charles, as we discussed, the seminal event of his younger years was the Pulaski disaster. His father recovered and married a year later.
And his father's name was?
Gasway Bug Lamar. And Gasway was a very accomplished, very successful, very innovative, wealthy Savannah businessman. And Charles went to some private schools in Pennsylvania and Virginia after the Pulaski, and he was even enrolled in the University of Virginia. However, he didn't last there long because by the age of 17, he was back in Savannah trying to become a businessman like his father. His early endeavors didn't work out, and before too long, he was actually working for his father which was a good thing. He had somebody stable overseeing his activities.
So his father was a merchant?
Yes, he was in banking, he was in shipping, mm-hmm. he was a merchant in the 1830s, 1840s sense of the term.
In Savannah.
In Savannah, okay. Yes. Yeah. But Gasaway's wife was ill, so in 1846, he moved up to New York with his wife and his second family, and Charles took over the business at the age of 22. And initially, things seemed to be going okay. He built a big warehouse on the river. He built a cotton press. So he was doing well, and he got involved in society. He became a captain of a militia unit at the age of 27, a very high honor. Militia units then were important organizations. They were the ones that would furnish troops to the U.S. Army should the need ever arise. Mm-hmm. Everything was going well, and then in the early 1850s, things started to unravel. 1850s. Mm-hmm. Century War.
Sure.
Yes, the 1850s. Right. And he got involved in the Cuban filibustering movement, which we described as this illegal activity. It was illegal, by the way, to overthrow rulers in Cuba, bring it into the United States. After that, and his some of his letters display his involvement in it, and he was the chief recruiter for men and money in Georgia. It wasn't very successful, but that was his role. He became an alderman in 1853. He was elected an alderman. He tried to...
In city government, here in Savannah.
In city government, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. And he tried to pass a law that would exclude Irishmen from political life. He was a Know-Nothing, a member of the Know-Nothing Party, which mm-hmm. was an anti-immigrant party.
Right.
He failed. He tried his efforts in that, passing laws in that regard, failed. But at least he was a member. But during that period of time, he was charged twice for assault on other individuals. Very interesting. The second charge was an assault with an attempt to murder. The charge was lowered to simply assault, and he got off with paying a fine. But it shows that there are cracks in the armor between that and getting involved in the filibustering movement. He got involved in the legal interstate slave trade. So even though the international slave trade was illegal, prohibited, importing slaves from foreign territories or Africa.
And let's just clarify real quick, the international slave trade had been illegal in the United States since 1808.
Correct.
So long before he was born. So by the 1850s, this had been illegal for 30 years almost.
Yes.
And, 50 years, excuse me.
If I just might add, yeah. mm-hmm. it was even illegal before that by all the individual states. Georgia had made it illegal in its constitution in 1798.
Okay.
So it was really illegal long before 1808. But at a federal level with U.S. Navy, it had weight behind the prohibition.
So he was involved in the interstate slave trade.
Yes.
Okay.
And he got involved with some partners, and they purchased some slaves from an estate in South Carolina. They brought them to Louisiana, New Orleans, and by all accounts, it failed miserably. Just like most of his business ventures.
So not a good businessman, really.
No. So
it really sounds like he's not a very nice guy either.
No, he sounds like he's the type of guy that would walk into a bar and buy drinks for everybody and start telling jokes.
And then eventually get in a fight with somebody.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So
go ahead. So he's involved in the interstate slave trade in the 1850s.
Yes. Yeah. And that fails. So it's a little confusing, but he's broke by this point. He invested in plank roads, which By now, the railroads are blooming, blossoming throughout Georgia, and plank roads are falling apart, but he invested heavily in plank roads. He invested in gold mines right when the gold rush of 1849 was happening, so all the people with expertise in gold, they were going out to the West Coast. His gold mines failed. His legal interstate slave trading failed. The businesses he was running for his father were failing. He's broke. So he went to New Orleans in early 1858, in March of 1858, to collect some money. He was desperate to collect some money from one of his partners. And while he was there, a beautiful sailing yacht comes into New Orleans Harbor. And while he doesn't write about it in his letters, he leaves New Orleans a few days later, and by the end of April, the yacht, the Wanderer, is in New York and owned by one of Charlie Lamar's partners. After that, events explode. They start outfitting the yacht. Now, of course, it's in New York. They had to be somewhat careful in how they outfitted the yacht, but they were putting 15,000-gallon water tanks in the yacht, water tanks capable of holding up to 15,000 gallons. Well, the authorities there saw that and said, that can only be for one or two reasons. They're going on a filibustering venture, or they're going on a slaving venture to Africa. The authorities had the ship seized. They brought it into New York Harbor, but this partner of Charlie Lamar's, his name is William Corey of Charleston, was a lobbyist in Washington. So he had to be a smooth talker, and that's the reason why Charlie brought him on board, and he sweet-talked his way through the New York authorities. The ship was let go. They took it to Charleston. The ship was further outfitted. It went on its trip to Africa, came back and landed its human cargo on Jekyll Island in November of 1858.
How many enslaved people were on the ship?
They packed 487 on the ship in Africa. They landed about 400 to 409. However, a statistic that's often ignored in accounting casualties in the slave trade is that a lot of the slaves died afterwards from diseases they contracted during the journey. Sure. So let's say 400, but it was probably less than that they could actually sell.
And what must have been a pretty horrific crossing with, as you said, disease and probably malnutrition and dehydration, etc. All the horrors of the Middle Passage. Mm-hmm. So Charles Lamar is partly famous because he landed what turned out to be the next to last shipment of slaves in the international slave trade on the coast of Georgia in 1858.
Yes, and the first one in about 40 years.
Yeah, and so what happened?
They distributed the slaves. 300 of them went up the Savannah River, eventually to a woodyard in Hamburg, South Carolina, which is a dead town, but it's across the river from Augusta. And those were basically Charlie's and several of his partner's slaves, and they sold them there at bargain basement prices. Charlie always sold this voyage as a tremendous money maker, where they could easily sell slaves as they walked off the ship for $650, $700. And there are records of him in his letters saying that they sold for $300 and mostly for notes, worthless notes. So Charlie's even failing in his illegal venture.
Was he prosecuted?
Yes, he was, but not for... In 1808, it was made illegal. In 1820, it was made an act of piracy, meaning conviction meant hanging, execution.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie was not tried for that. Charlie wasn't on the ship. Charlie did not go to Africa. William Corey went with others. Charlie stayed in Savannah. So he was charged with several offenses, but he was only convicted on one charge, and it was something that wasn't related to the voyage of the Wanderer. many of the participants, many of in the voyage, were arrested and brought to trial in Savannah. One of those arrested, a fellow by the name of John Egbert Farnham, a fairly famous filibuster of the time, was jailed. Actually, he was up in New York, and the authorities got him down into Savannah, and they jailed him. And Charlie broke him out of jail for a party at the Pulaski Hotel. And that was the only offense that he was, he pled guilty to it. So he spent 30 days basically under house arrest. Mm. But all the other charges, no, nobody would pay for the crime.
Wow. Wow. So he does his activities involved in the slave trading business, did this affect his social standing in this community of Savannah? Did anybody think that this was something that even a gentleman didn't get involved in? How did it affect him personally? Do you know?
I think Charlie was fairly immune to criticism about his involvement. And if I could divide Savannah populace into two broad classifications, there were those that despised Charlie for bringing bad light on Savannah, mm-hmm. which it did. Mm-hmm. And there were those that didn't approve of the international slave trade, but liked Charlie because he thumbed his nose at the North. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That would be how I describe. There were some people, of course, that hated Charlie for what he did, but those were the two broad categories. But he had support, but the support wasn't, we support the slave trade and we support Charlie.
Right.
We support Charlie because he was telling the North to take a hike.
And I assume that all of this, coming when he did in 1858, must have made the national news and probably played some role in fanning the flames of sectional conflict.
Absolutely made the news. But the interesting thing about the whole affair was it made the news when they landed the slaves, and a lot of the northern papers included it in there, but the fury of the North really didn't get started until the Wanderer got seized and was put up for auction in March of 1859. And Charlie was there, and he bought back the Wanderer. And during the auction, he stood in front of the crowd and said, "This is my ship. The feds took it from me. They had no right to. And during this auction, nobody better bid against me." So he goes in the crowd and he starts, I think the starting bid was $500, $405 or $500. And he raised his hand. And then sure enough, somebody bid against him. It was the city jailer, Charles Van Horn, whom Charles had made a fool of in a few months earlier in another escapade involving the Wanderer. So Van Horn starts bidding against Charlie, and they get it up to $4,000. Charlie thought he was going to get it back for $400. Now it's up to $4,000. Well, the auctioneer was a city marshal, Daniel Stewart, who was a friend of Charlie. So Stewart, after Charlie made the bid at $4,000 or $4,001, banged the gavel down and sold to Charles Lamar. Charles walked through the crowd and laid out the city jailer with one punch. For some reason, that drove the New York papers, especially the New York Times and the New York Tribune, crazy that he would behave like that, that that behavior would be accepted, and that this man could buy back his own ship. And that's when they started to cover the Wanderer in more detail and Charlie Lamar in more detail. And as a matter of fact, got so heavy in their criticism of Lamar that Lamar challenged the publisher and editor of the New York Times, Henry J. Raymond, to a duel. And Charlie pursued him for months trying to get him to duel, as he did Horace Greeley. Now, he didn't pursue Greeley. He pursued a reporter for the New York Tribune. Greeley was the editor. But he was going directly after Henry J. Raymond of the New York Times. He never got his duel. But
so this came 3 years after the Preston Brooks, Charles Sumner caning. So it sounds like he sort of perpetuated the idea that these Southerners are brash, they're arrogant, they're violent, and that they will use violence in order to protect and preserve slavery. He sort of embodied that, it sounded
like. Absolutely. Yeah. Even though there were newspapers in the South that criticized Lamar for getting involved in the slave trade, that it diminished the South for his involvement.
Yeah.
The Northern newspapers didn't look at that at all. They just looked at what Charlie Lamar was and mm-hmm. used him as the prototype rebel Southerner.
You mentioned that he died in April of 1865, literally at the very end of the Civil War. If you can very briefly tell us what he did during the war.
During the war, believe it or not, he forms a militia unit, a cavalry unit. And where is he assigned but Jekyll Island, the place where the Wanderer landed its cargo? He spends several months there, gets into some argument with his superiors, and gets kicked out of the army. Now, can you imagine Civil War, manpower is so tight, what do you have to do to get kicked out of the army? But you can see him telling off his officers, telling them they're a bunch of idiots, as he does in his letters to his father, and getting kicked out. So he gets kicked out. He goes to work for his father in Savannah, who now is selling guano as fertilizer, and of course still brokering cotton, but little brokering can be allowed with mm-hmm. the blockade.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gasway, his father, realizes that they really need fast steamships, so he sends Charlie over to England to buy them. Charlie does. He actually buys about three steamships. He comes back, and somehow or other, he gets back into the state militia, the Georgia State Militia, not the Confederate Army, but the Georgia, working for, reporting to, I should say, Howell Cobb, who he fights with during the Wanderer years to get permission to bring in African apprentices. This is all told in the book, but when Charlie was failing in his ability to bring in Africans on his first ship, the E.A. Rawlins, he decides, well, he's just going to bring in African apprentices. A ruse, of course,
mm-hmm.
to get around slavery. And mm-hmm. he gets into this big national battle with Howell Cobb, his uncle, who was the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, the ex-Governor of Georgia, the ex-Speaker of the House of Representatives. Now, and he insults him. He calls him a little man with a little object during this argument he's having over importing African apprentices. Now, 1864, 1865, Howell Cobb is the general in charge of the Georgia State Militia, and Charles is reporting to him and living in stationed in Columbus. And this is right about the time that Union General James Wilson is going through Alabama, subduing Alabama, and with intent of crossing the Chattahoochee and subduing Columbus. And when he comes over into Columbus, his troops invade Columbus, Charles is there, he gets involved in the battle and is shot and killed.
Two questions really quick. Where is he buried?
He was originally buried in Columbus, but his remains were interred, and now he's buried at Laurel Grove Cemetery.
So right here
in Savannah.
Okay.
Yes.
Is his father buried there too?
No. His father is buried in Alexandria, Virginia, which is, if I can segue over to how I got those papers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how Gasway...
One final question about the cargo and the Wanderer. I'm just fascinated. He lands at Jekyll Island. I forgot to ask you. Does he land openly and brazenly? He doesn't come under the cover of night and hush and secret. Is it open?
The reason why he landed on Jekyll Island was that in those days there was nothing on Jekyll Island but one plantation that was owned by the Dubinion family.
Mm-hmm.
So they came in on the evening of November 28th, Kari and the crew and the poor Africans. And Kari goes on land and immediately starts looking for a pilot to to take the Wanderer to the land side of Jekyll Island. And he finally finds somebody to do it, so they do it early the next morning. So that wasn't brazenly open. That okay. was meant to be done in secret.
Okay, right. All right, so segue now into the story of the letter book.
Okay. I feature Charles and Gasway Lamar in my first historical novel, Savannah Gray. And after I wrote Savannah Gray, I wrote an article about Charles Lamar for the Georgia Historical Quarterly. After that, I had my fill of the Lamars, and it was time to move on. So I started to write the sequel to Savannah Gray, and I was about a year into researching it, 2 years into researching and writing, when I get a call from the head archivist of the Georgia Historical Society. She had just received a call from a woman in New Jersey who had 3 steamer trunks full of Gasway Lamar papers in her attic. And she asked me if I wanted to go up there and authenticate the papers. And I said, sure. What an opportunity for a few historians get that opportunity to find long-lost papers of somebody that they had been researching for years. So I went up, flew up. Of course, I called the woman first and introduced myself and told her I was representing the Georgia Historical Society and I wanted to authenticate the papers. And she said, fine, come on up. But before I left, I asked the archivist, how in the world did the papers of a prominent Savannah Confederate businessman wind up in the attic of a New Jersey home in Montclair, New Jersey? And she said, I don't know. Ask the woman when you get there. So I flew up. The woman couldn't have been more gracious. She let me use her study for 3 days. And I went through the steamer trunks, and it was just a treasure trove of long-lost papers of Gasway Lamar, but his accounting books, his letter books. In his accounting book, I could see his purchase of the tickets the day before he left on the Pulaski.
Wow.
I could see him paying tuition for Charles Lamar going to University of Virginia. So while Charlie Lamar never recorded anything, Gasway recorded every penny, and it just shows almost day by day a diary of what he was doing. That along with his letters, because he recorded everything in his letters. And but sort of by the second day, I was getting bleary-eyed going through all these papers, and I picked up this book, a letter book. And you know, a letter book was, can I just take a second, in those days, business people, just to record copies of their letters, they would buy a bound copy of a book with blank pages. They would write a letter on a separate page and a separate ink. They'd put that on a top of a blotter. Then they'd put that underneath one of the blank pages in the letter book. Mm-hmm. They'd put a blotter over the blank page, and they'd screw it down. It was a letterpress. And the ink would seep up, and that's how they kept so many copies of their letters. Mm-hmm. Finally, I went through about 10 of Gasway's letter books. I pick up this other letter book, much thinner, and I started to read the letters, and they were Charlie Lamar's letters of his slave trading exploits and his filibustering exploits. And it was remarkable. I make a long story short, I bought the collection from the woman and donated it to the Georgia Historical Society. And I knew I had to write a book about it, so that's how the Slave Trader's Letter Book came about. But when I drove up there on a separate occasion to get the to take the collection back to Georgia, I asked the woman, how in the world did the papers of Gasway Bug Lamar, influential Confederate businessman, wind up in your attic in Montclair, New Jersey? And she said, I don't know. So I promised myself I would write the book, but I also promised myself I'd find out how those letters got there.
And had they just been sitting in her attic?
Yes.
And did she know they had always been there, or did she just make a discovery?
What happened is, after the war, Gasway's papers were confiscated by the Union Army, and they were sent up to Washington, and they were used by Washington to try to pin some charges on Gasaway because he made some enemies during his years in New York, especially his final years in New York. Remember, he lived in New York from 1846 to 1861. He didn't come back until 1861 when the war broke out.
And when did he die?
He died in 1874.
Okay, so he outlived
his son. The authorities, Union authorities, threw him in prison for 3 months. They let him out. He went back to jail two more times. After that, he spent the rest of his life trying to recover his money for his confiscated cotton and all his personal papers, because he had so many lawsuits going, he couldn't settle them without his personal papers, which were seized. In 1872, he still hadn't received his papers from the government. He went up to live in New York City with his daughter. In 1874, he finally settled his cotton case with the U.S. government for close to $600,000, which is about $12 million in today's dollars.
Settled in that the government paid him.
The government paid him.
Okay.
Government, true to its word, paid him. Took him a long time to get it. He fought and fought. He sued everybody in the government who he thought had something to do with confiscating it. He lost all those cases, but the Union government had set up a special fund for confiscated property of Southerners, and he signed his oath of allegiance as soon as Sherman came in, so he felt he was he deserved it, which is what they promised. And by the way, that oath of allegiance, signed oath of allegiance, it was in the papers that I eventually recovered. Mm-hmm. At any rate, he moves up to New York, lives with his daughter, makes out his last will and testament. He gets compensated for his cotton in 1874. He dies 6 months later. So his son was named as the executor in the will. And he tries to adjudicate the estate, I think that's the word, but the government still wouldn't release the papers to him. So by 1886, he still didn't have the papers. The son dies. So the daughter that Gasaway went to live with and her husband became the executors of the estate. And they tried to settle the estate, but they needed the papers to settle it because of all the open lawsuits. The daughter got run over by an omnibus while crossing Fifth Avenue in Manhattan in 1905. So her husband becomes the administrator of the estate. And there are drafts of letters to the War Department and the State Department asking, please return the papers. And this is in the 1915 area.
So 40 years after his death.
Yes. He still doesn't have the papers back. The husband dies. So their son, Gasaway's grandson, takes over. Finally, in the early 1920s, the estate is settled and the courts release the papers to the grandson, who lives in Montclair, New Jersey. So he takes them home and puts them up in the attic. He died in 1949. His wife, his widow, moved out of the house in 1950. Left the papers up there. The next buyer of the house lived there for about 10 years, never touched the papers. They moved out. Somebody else moved into the house, left the papers up there, didn't touch them, moved out until the couple in, I think, 1969 moved in and found the papers up there. The woman, the wife, wanted to throw the papers out, but the husband said, no, this is important stuff. Let's keep it. He died in 2009, and that's when she realized, I've got to get rid of these papers. She went to some auction houses, which offered a really incredible amounts of money, but she knew that they would split up the collection and sell it piecemeal, and she realized that its historical significance lay in it staying together as one collection. So she called the Georgia Historical Society, and they called me. And that's...
What a story. That's incredible, Jim. So 40 years after she buys the house, they decide finally that, well, after his death, that they're going to do something with these. So literally, you said he died, and the grandson dies in 1949.
Yes.
So 70 years 60 years, 60 mm-hmm. years after his death.
Yes.
The phone call comes to the Georgia Historical Society. So these things had been in steamer trunks in their attic for all these years, really since the 1920s, when they were first released. What kind of condition was everything in?
The accounting papers were in excellent condition. They were solid. A lot of the letters written on individual pieces of paper that Gasaway had received were in generally excellent condition. The letter books, because of that process where the ink had to seep through the pages, they had a more of an onion skin quality. So they were of varying condition. Some were very, very fragile. And as a matter of fact, I spent a lot of hours photographing each individual page for researchers so that they can't be handled by human hands anymore without damaging them.
But they can still be accessed.
But they can be accessed because they've been digitized.
And so to complete this story, you processed this collection, did you not, at the Georgia Historical Society?
Yes.
And how long did that take you?
Hundreds of hours over several years.
And did you feel like this was a labor of love? Did you feel like this was just a once in a lifetime opportunity for
scholars?
No, it was
a labor of love.
Yeah.
I know. Obviously, I had to read each of the individual papers as I went to know how to file it, and some of it was incredible, especially the letters from his family members that were on individual pieces of paper. So it was a great experience. Of course, I had the option of writing about Gasaway Lamar or writing about Charlie Lamar, and I thought I could write about Charlie more quickly because I had done more research on him than Gasaway. But there is a Gasaway Lamar book in there, but I don't know if I'm the man.
I was just about to ask, is that your next book?
I don't know. I'm going to finish promoting the Slave Trader's Letter Book for the rest of the year, and then I'll decide what to do next.
Well, Jim, it's an incredible story. Obviously, the Georgia Historical Society, the people of Georgia, the scholarly world owes you a huge debt and a thank you. Doesn't seem enough to cover it, but it's people like you who make scholarly research possible, people who recognize the value of this stuff, who have the means to purchase it, who do it, and then who make a generous gift to the world. So on behalf of Grateful Georgia Historical Society and all of our patrons and members, thank you. I hope, tell us a little bit real quickly about where you're going to be coming up promoting your book.
I am going to be attending the Southern Festival of Books in Nashville next weekend. That's October 12th and 13th, I believe. I will be going, when I come back, I'll be going up to Morrow, Georgia to receive an award from the Georgia Historical Records Advisory Council.
Congratulations.
Which is part of the University System of Georgia for the 2018 Award for Excellence in Documenting Georgia History. A great honor. I'm going to be going to the Miami Book Festival in November, another great honor. And those are the highlights, but I'll be speaking at many other places along the way. And as a matter of fact, I'll be speaking up at the Thomas Cobb House in Athens, Georgia in later November.
Excellent.
So lots of stuff coming up, and I'm excited about it. And again, it's a labor of love, so...
You haven't had your fill of the Lamars yet.
Well, we'll see.
it is strange company to keep, isn't it?
Yes,
so
it is.
Long.
It is.
Well, my guest has been Jim Jordan. The book is entitled The Slave Trader's Letter Book, Charles Lamar, The Wanderer and Other Tales of the African Slave Trade, published by the University of Georgia Press. Jim, congratulations on publication, on this great story. Thank you for saving this material, and good luck with promoting the book.
And thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
That concludes our interview with author Jim Jordan about his latest book, The Slave Trader's Letter Book, Charles Lamar, The Wanderer, and Other Tales of the African Slave Trade, published in 2018 by the University of Georgia Press. The interview was recorded in Savannah at the Jepson House Education Center at the Georgia Historical Society on October 3rd, 2018. The hardest working engineer in show business, now the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS under 40 soccer team, is Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our mailman this week and every week is Crimson Tide fan extraordinaire, one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised, that's right, who is away this week attending the National Cornbread Festival in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. But he promises to be back next week. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, "Our reputation has leaked out." Catering this week provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of Big Al's hard-boiled, aluminum foil, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Standard Oil, Gargoyle, soon to be unemployed, try to avoid, watch the recoil, maintain your poise, eat it before it spoils, drippy enchilada. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. Tell your friends and family, because why suffer through all of this alone? You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Please also check out my blog and similarly painful podcast at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about this show or about life in general, drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you'll come back next week. So long, everybody.